So, welcome to what possibly will be the last in the series of which I've called Audio Terror. This is part five, and I am absolutely delighted to have someone with me today who really is both an inspiration to me and someone that I have had the great pleasure of being able to play with over the last few months, and someone who in some way, in a sort of indirect way, I suppose, got me into this whole podcasting gig by putting out what I think is one of the best, if not the best, Lovecraft mythos horror podcasts out there. And of course, it is the inimitable Scott Dorwood, the hardest working man in podcasts. Hi, Scott.
Thank you very much, Andy. I see no way I can live up to that build-up you've just given me.
just live it. Live the dream, Scott. Live the dream. Own it, I think they call it. Own it.
Okay.
I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast knows who you are, but maybe you can just give a quick intro and plus plug for whatever you want.
Sure, yes. Well, I've done a bunch of freelance writing, primarily for Call of Cthulhu, but also other Lovecraftian role-playing games. I worked on Call of Cthulhu 7th edition, Masks of Nyarlathotep, the new version. Oh, all sorts of other stuff. And I also, as Andy mentioned, do a bit of podcasting. The Good Friends of Jackson Elias has been going for, I think, about 8 years at this stage, and shows no sign of slowing down. This is the podcast I do with my good friends Paul Fricker and Matt Sanderson, wherein we talk about primarily Call of Cthulhu, but weird fiction horror films, other horror games, and just whatever it is that's sort of inspiring us as writers and gamers. I also record, obviously, with you, Andy, as part of Grizzly Peaks, and I'm sure we'll get into some of that. And yes, I'm a cast member on How We Roll, an actual play podcast where I've been running the two-headed serpent for them for what feels like forever. And yeah, I'm a semi-regular on Ain't Slayed Nobody. I'm not part of the main arc there, but I do a lot of one-shots with them.
Damn it, I knew I'd got the name wrong. I referred to it as Yawl of Cthulhu. But that's the name of the...
Yawl of Cthulhu is the name of the main arc, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I was actually trying to think, are you on any others? Because I referred to all your different actual plays in a previous episode. Is there any other actual plays you've been in? Are you in any of the Chaosium ones? I know they do.
No, I haven't done any of those. I did do a guest spot for a few episodes on Pretending to Be People. And I'm sure I did something else.
Oh, you played. I know more than I know you better than you do. You played Joshua Meadham, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
In Aaron Vanek. Was it Aaron Vanek?
Yes.
Something else. Who was it? I don't know. It
was Aaron Vanek, yeah. That wasn't a podcast. So what Aaron had been doing is he'd been running this Two-Headed Serpent campaign for his home group for some time, and then during lockdown, obviously it had all gone online. And so he decided to take the opportunity to bring people in, primarily voice actors he knows, because he works in theatre. And he brought a bunch of actors in basically to play NPCs at various times. And for the climax part, he contacted me and said, well, would you like to come on and play Joshua Meadham? And, I had an absolute blast.
Who better?
I almost killed one of the player characters. Almost.
Next time, eh, Scott? Next time. did you create the Meadham, the Caduceus in, organization? Yes. Was that yours or was that one of the others? Yeah. Really great.
Oh, sorry. I think I'm slightly lagged, so we're talking over each other a bit. So.
It's okay.
Yes. Sorry, to answer your question. Yeah. So the way we did the Two-Headed Serpent was we divided the chapters up between us. But I mean, we also contributed to each other's chapters just with ideas, particularly through playtesting, but just through conversation and through various bits in. So we all had hands in all of the chapters. But Matt wrote the mafia arc for the New York chapter. He wrote North Borneo, and he wrote the Belt and Congo chapter. Paul wrote the Bolivia, the Oklahoma, and the Calcutta chapter. And I wrote sort of the main campaign framework with Cadesius and all that, as well as the Iceland and Brazil and Mu chapters.
Wonderful. Yeah. No, because for some weird reason, I'm very forensic. It's not, you don't have the same clear copyright at the beginning of that book that says who wrote what, like you do in some of the other Chaosium books. So I've spent time trying to figure out who wrote what. I figured you wrote Iceland. I don't know. It felt like you somehow.
that's because it's the chapter that's notorious for killing off player characters. You get halfway through the campaign. It's
indeed.
Suddenly, yeah. You lose half the party.
Indeed. And as you know, I'm running two editors at the moment, but we've kind of stalled out just before Iceland. So, I mean, even as you managed to even kill pulp characters in Iceland, that's impressive.
Oh, yes. Yes. I don't know if you've seen Seth Skorkowski's videos. He did a fantastic video series on the two-headed serpent. And in the Iceland chapter, he talks about characters getting through certain things there by spending all their luck and surviving certain death. And there's a climactic bit in the video where he's talking about one character trying to make a getaway as things are going badly wrong and coming a cropper. And sort of, well, it's all right, buddy. You've got 30 luck, right? Right? Oh, no.
Yes, there's a certain, let's say, a certain vehicle, should we call it?
Yes.
Yes, let's leave it at that, because I don't want my players to have any spoilers, or I guess we shouldn't put spoilers in anyway. But anyway, this is wonderful background and context, because what this little mini series is, and you've had some idea of it because we talked about it after the game on Saturday, is my thoughts or desire to run a game or a series of sessions where we try and create something that genuinely is frightening for people to listen to. And my speculation on whether this is possible, and if it is possible, then how do we do it? Because I've been listening to a lot of horror audio dramas recently, and I've been impressed with a lot of them. I know not everyone is. It's because I've been sharing them with friends, and some say, no, it's not for me, or it's a bit hokey, or you know, the voice acting isn't great. But I find that what they all share is this strange ability to sort of worm their way into your brain in some way through sound, through voice. I liken it to the feeling you get listening to someone telling a ghost story around a campfire. It doesn't have to be a great performance, but there's something inherent in talking about horror that actually has quite a powerful effect on you. And so I'm thinking we should be able to do it. We have many tools at our disposal. And, you know, I wanted you to help me work through this idea, because I think you've given some examples, which we can talk about maybe, of producing quite scary audio content through the actual plays you've been involved in, I believe, particularly the cult stuff you've done for How We Roll, but also, you know, Blackwater Creek, for instance. That's a classic, for me, that's a great example of icky horror, and you ran that in a really delightful way. I think that was the first time you ran something for How We Roll.
It was, yeah.
But the cult stuff, more recently is a different type of horror. It's a much more insidious sort of psychological horror, or the horror of existential horror, or whatever you want to call it. A lot of stuff there. I've just unloaded on you, but why don't you tell me a little bit about, one, whether you think it's possible to create truly scary audio through a gaming actual play, and if so, how would you go about it?
I think it's very difficult. There are all sorts of inherent problems, I'd say, because if you're talking about a horror audio drama, you've got a lot more control over that. I mean, for a start, you've got professional voice actors, they're working to a script, you've had a chance to hone all the dialogue, you're adding sound effects, which, you know, you don't always have in APs, but you can certainly add in post-production. But the overall effect, I think, is very different. And I'm not entirely sure that a game should aspire to be like an audio drama, because games are much more active things, that they're the interplay between people, and there's always going to be an element of the unexpected. People are going to bring different things to them, and as a result, you can't plan them in the same way as you do fiction. I know it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine who writes horror fiction a while back about this, because he was asking me about how you write role-playing game scenarios, because though he's done a lot of role-playing, he's never actually written any scenarios. And we sort of came to the conclusion between us, and the way he phrased it is that when you're writing a horror scenario, you're writing, or a role-playing game scenario in general, you're writing sort of the negative space of a story. You're creating the area in which the story happens. And that, obviously, then you can control a lot of that through the GMing, but yeah, it is in the end going to be inherently unpredictable. So you've got that for a start. You've got the fact that because it's a social activity, I think you're almost going to struggle to keep the humor out of it. And we'll come back in a moment as to whether you should keep the humor out of it. That's a different question. But the off-topic jokes, the digressions, all the things that deflate atmosphere, that people do, I think partly because it's a social activity, partly to diffuse the tension, partly because it's a game and you're engaging with mechanics and things like that, and that sometimes takes you out of the atmosphere of the game. And I think ultimately you've got to resign yourself to the fact that that is going to produce a very different experience. And going back to that idea of humor, that's a weird one, because I mean, comedy and horror have always been kissing cousins, and there's a lot of humor in horror in general. When you have a tense situation in a horror film, you're going to diffuse that tension either through a shock or through a joke, and sometimes both at the same time. And I think that happens just as much, if not more, in role-playing games. And that's fine, because the humor very rarely, I think, completely negates the horror. That in a game, it's very difficult, as it is in a horror film, to run at 100% tension all the time. That would get exhausting. You need those ebbs and flows of tension. You need to build suspense and then release it. And humor, as well as horror, I think, does a great job of that. So as long as people are taking the game itself seriously and not trying to undercut what's going on through silly jokes, then I think a bit of humor is always going to work. But ultimately, I don't think horror RPGs are ever really that scary.
No, they aren't. They inherently aren't. Although, because in the end, everything is sort of defined, or large parts of it are defined and written down and given stats and all of that. But I think maybe what I found scary about hearing your cult games, that I don't know the game at all. I don't know the setting. I don't know the entities. So everything was new and scary or creepy, at least, like, what the hell is this? But the horror didn't come from the monsters, not really. It came, and I put it down to two things, which is what I found very interesting about it. I put it down to Craig's GMing, because he, and Craig, if you ever listen to this, don't take this badly, but he is kind of creepy sounding. Just his way of speaking is quite unnerving. If you see what
He's
I
not
mean.
like he's not like that when he's not GMing. That is something that he puts on for the game.
Right.
So
Okay.
I don't think you're insulting him by calling him creepy there. That's what he's
Okay,
going for.
fine. But he's going for it, and yeah, I realize that. But he's really good at that kind of just that kind of little drip, drip, drip in the back of your head. There's something is wrong here kind of voice. So he's really good at that. So the way he described the situations was unnerving. And then the other thing was your interactions as characters. You all had clear and possibly malevolent intentions from the off, being particularly in the first one where you're all criminals of some kind, or you're dodgy geezers. And that worked really well because it wasn't antagonistic, it wasn't PvP, but you're all clearly quite willing to do horrible things to get through.
Yeah, and completely did it for ourselves. Yeah.
And that sort of interplay with you, and you all took the roles very seriously, I thought created a really quite unnerving, at least, if not at points scary, effect.
Yeah, I think I don't know what we did there that I wouldn't normally do in a game. I guess because, you know, it had been pitched to us as a cult game, and I played some cult before, so I know what the tone of the setting was going to be like, and I knew that it was going to be a fairly dark scenario. Then I suppose there was always going to be a lot less in the way of deliberately deflating or diffusing the situation through humor. That there, we spent a lot of the game laughing, but I think we did take the whole thing very, very seriously. But beyond that, yeah, I'm not sure that, I mean, I can't speak for the other two, but I'm not sure that there's anything that I did there that I wouldn't necessarily have done in another game.
And maybe it wasn't that as so much as just that conjunction of many different things coming together, just pushed it into that territory. Because when I listened to the other How We Roll horror arcs, there's a couple of things going on, I think, that stop it from being outright horror. One, there's the jokiness of most of the players. You know, everyone does like a good joke. It is almost, from the off, a horror comedy podcast. It has been from the beginning. Okay. There's been humor has been a huge part of its appeal. The way Joe runs it, really, and I guess the way you're running it now, because I'm thinking back to the past when Joe used to run it, used to GM, let's say, the way that GM, that Joe and you GM opens the door for that, for those, awful comedy moments, you know, you're encouraging it. Which is great because it makes it very appealing. But I felt that the way that Craig ran it in the cult was very different. I think he was putting the, one, you were clearly on a path to doom from the beginning, and I think that's part of cult, isn't it, really?
Well, cult's a bit more complex than that, because it's both simultaneously a path to doom and destruction, but also potentially, particularly in campaign play, it's also a path to, I guess, sort of ultimate power. That, you know, the basic premise of the game is that all of humanity were once gods, and, you know, we've sort of been imprisoned or in this illusion that has denied us our inherent divinity, and that it's about sort of seeing through the cracks in the illusions and finding ways that we can go back and restore our lost divinity.
I see. I never knew that, because I've never read any of the books. To me, it sounded like it was a very specific type of I suppose supernatural power entities, sort of angels and demons, but real angels.
Basically cult is Gnostic Christianity, the role-playing game,
right?
Which is an approach I don't think anyone else has really done. I mean, the closest we've ever seen to that, I think, in media is The Matrix, which is somewhat different in tone.
A little bit different. So here's what we're going to try and do. And we've talked about this a little bit, but I've now spent several hours now talking to the other players. I did an episode where I, on my own, just walking in the hills near me, where I was rambling on about horror audio and the sound of horror. I talked a bit also about Stephen King's three types of horror, which I'm sure you know, that essay he wrote, or at least should I you're looking a little bit like you maybe don't.
It's ringing a bell, but was that something that he put into either On Writing or Danse Macabre?
I think it's on,
yeah,
Danse Macabre, else? That's it. Yeah,
yeah, I read Danse Macabre. Yeah, I read that 40 years ago, so there's
well,
the ghost
then
of the memory.
You should have bloody remembered. I mean, come on, Jesus Christ. No, so anyway, just to simplify, he talks about three levels of horror, and I was actually thinking the first one you can easily do in a podcast. The second one is really hard, and the third one may be possible. So the first one is the gross, he calls it gross out. So yeah. You are the master of the gross out horror, as Blackwater Creek evinces, because that's easy to do in a podcast, because you just describe something disgusting. And actually, you do get a reaction from the players, I found. I've been running David Larkins. David Larkins' amazing Berlin cycle. And that is full of disgusting stuff. It really, he has a really viscerally horrible imagination. So that stuff's great. And the players are going, ugh, all the time when I describe stuff. It's great. So that's easy. Second one, I think, is really hard because of the format. The second one is, he just calls it horror. The first one's gross out. The second one he calls horror. And that's the appearance of the monster. The thing about to tear your throat out with its claws. I think that's very hard to achieve that in pure audio because it is so much the shock of seeing something.
I wonder whether you still get an element of that with the sense of revelation, with the sense of stumbling across or encountering things that you'd really rather not have encountered, and just letting your imagination fill in the details. And I agree it's difficult, but I'm pretty sure that I've had that happen during games.
Well, that's interesting. I think the problem also is once you're familiar with the monsters, they're not scary anymore. That, you know, you're never scared of monsters in D&D because you okay. So then the third one, and I think this is more possible but difficult. He calls it terror, and that's the seeing something out the corner of your eye. When you turn your head, it's not there, but then you can feel it following you home in the dark, kind of thing. That creepy, like nothing's happening, but you know that danger is just lurking.
Yeah, I think you definitely can. And actually, going back to the horror aspect, I think, it is possible. It's rare, but it is possible to have that work in games. And sound can help an awful lot with that. I do remember a couple of times where, in games, for example, I've undercut something violent suddenly happening or the appearance of a monster or whatever, just simply by slamming my hand down on the table. And, the sudden start and jump as that happens. It's just an autonomic reflex. It's very simple, but it does, I think, sort of fill in that gap of not being able to see the horror. And, I mean, similarly, I will make sound effects sometimes in games. So, I'll do heavy breathing or kind of slobbering sounds and your wet noises and stuff like that to illustrate things that are happening with unnatural entities. And I think those can again go quite a long way towards building that sense of horror, because as long as you've got some sensory input in there, your mind will do the rest.
That's really interesting. I think it might be in the, there's like this, someone wrote this little dialogue sheet for this was years ago before you wrote your edition of Masks of Nyarlathotep, about your encounter with the Black Pharaoh, because in the original book it's not very fleshed out about what happens, and someone wrote this really detailed, like almost like a script, and then it recommends at various points that you actually get up and start walking around the group you know, as you're talking to them as the Black Pharaoh. And then when you're talking to someone, you kind of lean in and you maybe whisper in their ear and things like that, which obviously we can't do that now. But that's kind of similar idea, is that you need to somehow heighten the tension in that way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're in the same physical place as the other players, you can use physicality an awful lot in that respect. The time I've probably done that most effectively, I'm genuinely scared a player, and it was great. It was something so unexpected from my end as a GM as well, because we were playing in a busy gaming hall at a convention, so it was like the least atmospheric environment you could have had for a horror game. Lots of games going on, lots of rowdy games going on all around. And so I've got this small group of players who I'm running Dead of Night for, and I'm describing them as kids going up to this abandoned warehouse. And one of them says, oh, yeah, I want to see whether there's anything inside before we go in. Is there a window I can look through? And I said, well, there's one a bit high up. And he said, oh, okay, right. Well, I'll clamber on some crates and get up and you know, see whether I can take a look. And I said, well, it's quite dark inside. And I said, all right, well, I'll cup my hands over my eyes, put them up to the glass and take a look. And so I just, you know, I was walking around the table anyway, because I do tend to do that thing of walking around when I'm GMing. And so I was standing beside him at the time anyway. And so I just suddenly looked down until we were just nose to nose, just moved my face right in front of his and just said, there's a face. And he just about shat himself.
That's brilliant. You might get the police call on you if you do that these days at a convention. I don't know. well, actually, especially with COVID. This is interesting because that building up that. You know, I think that's interesting. I think what I've found from listening to a lot of these horror podcasts is that the appearance of the monster never works. And the things that I've listened to in these audio dramas or podcasts is, you know, I've listened to some really well-produced ones. One I got a tip from Evan Dorkin, your pal from Tear Them Apart, was the Salem's Lot adaptation that the BBC did years ago. It's now available on YouTube. It's excellent. But as I've said in the previous episode, the weakest bit is when they're fighting the vampires, because all you hear is kind of crunching and screams and you've no idea what's going on at that point, because what's scary is the build up to it. But as soon as the monster appears, it's like it gets weaker. And they also did American Werewolf in London, BBC. They did a great adaptation of that as well. Same problem. Essentially, it's identical to the film script. Both great, actually. Both Salem's Lot. I've never read or seen the whole TV movie all the way through, because I just thought it looked really terribly cheesy, the TV movie of it. It had David Soul in it, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I think it's one of these things that if you saw it as a kid at the time, you know, it probably scarred you for life, but hasn't necessarily aged that well. Everyone I know who's about my age, who saw it when they were, you know, 10, 11, 12, whatever, it certainly made an impression on them seeing it at that age.
Yeah, it was on TV when I was around that age. I guess it was. Well, he wrote it in the mid-70s, so I don't know when I guess late 70s.
I think it was 79 it came out. So, I've had this conversation with Paul about this, Paul Fricker, because Paul's 2 years younger than I am. So I was 14 when it came out, and I liked it. I mean, I'd read the book at that stage, I think, and I liked it, but it didn't really scare me. It didn't traumatize me in that way. Paul was 12 when he saw it, and this was his first exposure. And it's like those 2 years made a huge difference. And he was absolutely terrified by it.
I'm sure. Well, maybe I was just a bit of a weird kid, because I would have been 10, 11 when it came out. And I just looked at it and thought, this looks really cheesy. because it's cheap. It's fairly cheaply made, isn't it? It's not like a high budget. It's kind of like guy on a string kind of thing. hanging outside the window.
I mean, yes, I mean, it was low budget and it was also American broadcast television or network television, so they couldn't necessarily be too extreme. But on the other hand, it was made by Toby Hooper, who was the man behind the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Poltergeist as well.
I didn't know that.
So,
although there is debate, isn't there, about whether he or Spielberg directed Poltergeist? But anyway,
no, I mean, there was some debate, but Spielberg's been quite straight about the fact that no, Toby Hooper did direct it. That Spielberg's gone on record in recent years as saying there's nothing to those rumours.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. You've enlightened me. I guess, anyway, I don't want to get into Poltergeist. Poltergeist, now that scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. I mean, of course did. Jesus Christ, the tearing that the face when he pulls his skin off his face. Jesus. Oof. Although I think the scariest thing was the thing under the bed, because when you're a kid, like the thing under the bed is literally your nightmare fuel. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean,
see, I think I blocked it out because I didn't remember what it was. All I remember was something grabbed. Yeah.
Again, I was a bit older. I think I was 15 or 16 when that came out. And yeah, it still scared the hell out of me. It wasn't a question of it sort of playing on my fears as a child, because I wasn't quite a child at that stage. But it was still a bloody scary film.
Yeah. And it was a PG, wasn't it? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was marketed as a sort of family film. Yeah, I know. That was one of the things I loved about it, the fact that I'd gone into it thinking that it was going to be something safe, and it wasn't. It was not a safe film.
No.
And, yeah.
Well, because, that's Spielberg. Spielberg's associated, but you think, oh, it's going to be family-friendly.
But yeah, but Toby Hooper, gore, Andy. Toby Spielberg. Hooper.
Yeah, that's true. He does like his gore, Spielberg. I mean, Raiders has a pretty horrible gore effect at the end. Well, that's the gross out. The gross out. Spielberg really is a good gross out man. But
I was just going to say, with the gross out, one thing that I do want to say, because I'm always a passionate defender of this, that, you know, the gross out and body horror in particular, I think often gets maligned because, yes, it is easy to do, but I don't think that means that it's in any way lesser than the other forms of horror, because particularly in its form of body horror, I think that it relies on a lot more than just simple revulsion, that there's an existential aspect to the whole thing as well. It plays into our fears of death. It plays into our fear of disease. It plays into our fear of being this sort of mind trapped in an aging, rotting body. And there is something, I think, quite deeply existential to it. I often find myself really defending that side of it when it sort of gets swept aside as, yes, all right, this is the easy option, but your real horror is the M.R. James ghost story or whatever. James wrote a good ghost story. He also put some fairly disgusting things in those. Horror isn't just an intellectual exercise, and I think it's at its strongest when it ties in with our fears of mortality and being human. And that, to me, is very much, the gross outside of things.
Absolutely. I love gross out horror. It's one of the reasons I enjoy watching horror films is to see how clever the special effects are. And, these days, I guess with CGI, it's not quite as... It seems like a bit of the fun has gone out of it now. When you look at, let's say, the physical effects in The Thing, for instance, which are just extraordinary, really. Yeah. Probably the pinnacle of what do they call it?
Practical effects.
Practical effects, yeah. Probably the pinnacle of that. That's what makes the film so incredibly rewatchable, is just because you can never really take it all in. It's so overwhelming when you see it. Yeah. The chest burster from Alien as well, like the iconic moment, probably one of the iconic moments of cinema of all time.
Yeah, yeah. I think the 80s were a fantastic time for For that style of special effects. So, sorry, this is going wildly off topic, but have you seen
No.
there's a documentary that came out a couple of years ago, and there's a sequel that's just come out in the last month or two, called In Search of Darkness.
Oh, okay.
They're fantastic documentaries about 80s horror, particularly American horror. And each one of them goes through the 80s year by year, looking at releases that came out there, and then doing these
Wonderful.
sort of talking, these brief interview segments with people who were involved with them or, people who are fans of them. Each one of these films is of an epic length. Each one of them is, I think, 4.5 hours long. So that's, I mean, between the two, that's like 9 hours worth of documentary material. But yeah, if you're a fan of 80s horror at all, I really, really recommend them. They're on Shudder in the UK. I don't know if they are elsewhere.
I will definitely look that. I'm looking it up now. Yes, to 4 hours and 24 minutes. Goodness me, that sounds absolutely. Because I was fascinated by video nasties when I was growing up.
Oh, God, yeah.
I didn't have a chance to see many of them until I was older, of course. Because when you're 11, it's a bit hard to get hold of them unless you've got very, very, very morally dubious older cousins or
Well, I was
whatever. But
really, really lucky because I went to boarding school in the UK when for my A levels, and my aunt used to live up in Macclesfield, and she and her partner at the time ran a video store up there. And whenever I'd have a half term, I'd go up and visit them, and they'd put me up for the weekend and just say I could watch whatever I wanted. And this was when I was like 17 or 18, and so I'd just go through. And this was just before the video nasty furore. So this was when all of these films were still on the shelves and uncensored. And so I sort of, jokingly, but only half jokingly, refer to that as my real education at the time. I was a terrible academic student, but the films that I saw whenever I went up there for long weekends, I mean, those taught me so much about what I do now that's the education I use.
Yeah, Driller Killer was your
Oh yes,
Wuthering Heights, was it?
pretty much, pretty much.
I've never actually seen it. Apparently, it's
Oh yeah.
not that great, is it, Driller
Oh,
Killer?
it's not bad. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was Abel Ferrara. It was sort of. I don't know if it
Yeah,
was his
true.
first film, but yeah. I mean, he went on to have quite a distinguished career after that. And yeah, I think
Cool. Yeah.
it's an underrated film.
Okay. All right. Basket Case, on the other hand, I really
Oh
enjoyed that.
yes. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's yeah. So you said something a bit earlier that I'm going to pick up on because it's really
Sure.
interesting. I'm part of the Anchor podcasting network. What that means is I have a podcast on Anchor through which there's a sort of instant gaming podcasters community because that's just it just I don't know that's how I got into it. And a friend of mine on there called Safer Fantasy Crafting, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Oh, yeah.
He put out an episode just after my last episode, it, as a sort of response episode to mine, which is what's so great about Anchor is that we all just it's like an ongoing conversation through podcasts. It's great.
Oh,
And
nice.
he said that he talked about the horror that he finds interesting. He doesn't find those kind of Stephen King type horrors compelling. He finds existential horror compelling. That's the type of horror he really enjoys. And you talked about that in relation to the body being decaying and your realization of the true, your mortality and things like that. And of course, Lovecraftian horror is so much about existential horror, cosmic horror, as you've talked about at length on Good Friends. I think this is something that's missing from Stephen King's tripartite horror because I don't think he necessarily explores it that much, at least not that I'm aware of, but it is a really big part of the sort of mythos story is you realizing what your place is in the universe, you coming to terms with the horror or not, as the case may be, and then descending into madness and spiraling to your doom. I think this is something that we can play up in a game and in a sort of role-playing actual play. I think we can do it really well, but it's very much based on the players, how they make their characters react to what they experience.
Yes.
I don't think it's much about the GM at that point.
Well, I think it's about both. I think the GM has got to create the circumstances for the players to engage with in that way. It's hard to react in terms of existential or cosmic horror to something that, you know, does not really have that aspect of the numinous or the ineffable to it. I mean, we did, you know, entire episodes about this, as you mentioned, on The Good Friends, just trying to pin down a lot of what makes that work, particularly within a gaming context. And I mean, at the risk of sounding heretical here, I don't think Lovecraft is always a particularly good model for that. I don't think, I mean, despite the fact that his name is synonymous with cosmic horror, I don't think that he's the best proponent of it by a long chalk. Because there are things that he does in his stories which I think undercut the philosophy that's behind them. So his gods and monsters have names, they have descriptions. You know, even the really alien ones are described often very much in human terms. And I think that works very much against the atmosphere of transcendence, or, you know, as I mentioned before, the ineffable that he's trying to present. We recently on The Good Friends did an episode about Algernon Blackwood's The Willows, which I think is a far better example of cosmic horror than anything Lovecraft ever wrote, simply because he doesn't explain anything. He doesn't give stuff names. You know, there's no revelation at the end that it is this entity, and, you know, this is what its cult's like, and, you know, this is how humans have interacted with it before. It's just presented as this almost force of nature, but something that is beyond nature. And I think that creates a far greater sense of cosmic horror. And so, you know, in a game, if you're trying to create that sense, then, you know, describing to the players these series of phenomena that's going on, these, you know, these weird things, these threatening, incomprehensible manifestations that are happening around them, that's great. And that really will work towards a sense of that cosmic horror. And if you can use that in a way that makes them feel, yeah, like there are forces on a cosmic scale, then that perhaps brings in that sense of existential horror as well. But as soon as you start giving them names, if you know, after all that, you say, oh yeah, and it's actually Yog-Sothoth, then yeah, you've just undercut everything you've just done.
Can I, in the case for the defense, present to you The Color Out of Space?
That is, I've always said that I think is Lovecraft's most successful story. It's certainly his best cosmic horror, and yeah, I think if he'd written more stuff like that, as opposed to, I mean, the counter argument I say would be The Dunwich Horror, which I think has got a lot of great cosmic horror elements in it, but, you know, ultimately, Lovecraft, I think, undercuts himself in too many places. I mean, you can make arguments.
He makes it
that perhaps...
I think what he does is he makes it too much like a traditional adventure structure, adventure story structure, where you figure out what's going on and then you defeat the evil kind of thing.
But it's not just that. It's that, I mean, all right, we're seeing it through the lens of what the Whately family believes, but we've got detailed explanations of Yog-Sothoth and what he is and what his plans are, and, you know, physical descriptions of his children and stuff like that. And it's unsettling and it's portrayed in weird ways. But in the end, you know, there's nothing that feels that mysterious about it. It's all far too comprehensible.
Yes, you're right, but there's something about it that really got to me the first time I read it. I think little pieces of it are very unsettling, like the way that Whately Jr. describes clearing off the earth once the earth is cleared off, which is such a brilliant phrase because it's so casual, and yet the implications of it are so horrifying.
Oh, and also the whole idea that the Earth's current state and its location and so on is an aberration, that this is something that, you know, the circumstances that allow us to live are something that probably shouldn't be. And so you've got this entity that's basically coming back to restore things to how they should have been and take the, you know, take the Earth back to where it should be. And, oh, yeah, coincidentally, that's going to kill us all. But, yeah, that really does sound like, you know, someone bring the exterminator in just to sort out the termite infestation in their house or something like that, and where the termites.
Indeed. Do you know the two sci-fi stories from Clark Ashton Smith's collection, The End of the Story? The one about them going to Venus and the one about the Venusians coming to Earth.
Probably. I read all of Clark Ashton Smith's fiction, but again, this was 35 years ago. So, yes, once I did, I can't remember the details now.
So they are both cosmically horrifying in a way, particularly the one where they go to Venus, because they don't understand anything that's going on there. I've actually done a podcast episode about this actual story. Both these stories with Barney, coincidentally. We called it appendicitis. We called it appendicitis because it was our thoughts on what should have been an appendix N but wasn't.
Oh, nice. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So, and weirdly enough, Clark Ashton Smith isn't in appendix N. You know, appendix N is Guy Gaetz's list of story, but of authors that inspired D&D. And it was like, how can Clark Ashton Smith not be in there?
That's a major oversight.
Major oversight. I mean, especially because actually most of this stuff is sort of fantasy. It's not so much science fiction, although there is some. But anyway, these two stories I found really horrifying, much more horrifying than anything Lovecraft ever wrote. Because one, I think Clark Ashton Smith is a better writer. Yes. You know, like technically he's a better writer. And secondly, I think because there was never any explanation of what these things were. Like in the Venusian one, they go because the last ship that went just never returned, never. And they realize that the entire Venusian ecosystem is just killing, is going to kill them. And they encounter worse and worse monstrosities until they get to the point where it's like, you know, a half a continent-sized organic entity that's just flowing across the landscape. And they think it's like a natural form, but it's actually an organism that's going to try and kill them. So it's fascinating. Yeah.
Sorry, I cut out there for part of that. Am I back now?
Yes, you're back.
Oh, okay.
You're back.
Okay.
All right. Well, I just made a point about Clark Ashton. We can drop that. But just to finish off then. No, it's okay. It's okay. So just to finish off, then, for this game that we're trying to set up, or I'm trying to set up, part of it, I think we've all agreed, you've got to have stakes. You as characters have to feel like you are under threat. You're not just random people randomly happening upon something awful. I think that's key. I think that was a great observation by you, and something that we'll definitely do. I think that's relatively easy to do. We create characters that are somehow involved in the story right from the beginning, in some way, or it's, you know, their objective is very tightly tied in with the story. In terms of what, you know, the structure of how we play, you know, we joke around a bit with Barney and others that the White Dwarf sessions, as I now call them, the reason we're having so much jokey stuff is that we don't really get to the horror for ages and ages in most of them.
Yeah, well, I think there are all sorts of reasons why we joke around more on those, and I was trying to put my finger on that because it does sort of tie in with what you're doing, and I think part of it is just simply because they are from a different era when. Yeah, the original Call of Cthulhu scenarios, I'd say, were very different beasts in that respect. That they were, certainly the White Dwarf ones were very tongue-in-cheek often, and But it's more than that. It's the tone of them, I think, because we're all of a similar age, takes us back to those first days of playing Call of Cthulhu when we probably didn't play it at all seriously. And yeah, it's just like this time machine back to being a teenager again and romping around like we used to in adventures like this at the time.
Nostalgia is what do they say about nostalgia, that it's a poison or something?
Yeah.
I don't know, there's an expression I've heard,
but it's also damn good fun.
Absolutely. I'm loving it. It's not that I want to play it differently. It was almost like I want to see whether we can do this experiment, because I don't know, maybe I'm thinking that we can, you know, have create something more enjoyable to listen to for the listener, or more compelling somehow, if we can make it scary as well. And I think if we can get both, if we can get both something that's scary and something that's funny, then we've hit a home run.
I mean, as I said, I don't know if it'll ever get to this stage, or how likely it is to get to the stage of actually scaring the listener. But certainly, yeah, I think it's possible to, as you mentioned before, go for that approach of terror, of giving people the creeps, if not actually scaring them. And yeah, that certainly, I think, is a very realistic goal.
I mean, it's interesting what can create that, because just, I know it's a bit of a cliched meme now, but the Slender Man as a sort of idea is quite scary. If you dig down and dive into it, it becomes a bit banal. But the first time I came across it, I was like, oh, you know what? That's actually quite a scary concept, quite a scary mental image it's creating. A lot of these before you know anything about them, they can be quite scary. And maybe that's part of it. It needs to be very, very brief and alluded to. But what I want to end on then is, you know, Barney was very insistent that we've got to cut out all the preamble, all the slow, like, investigation. Start with a bang. Put you into danger immediately and then see what happens.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I mean, I've written an awful lot of horror scenarios over the years, and a fair number of them do start with exactly that. I think some of the more successful ones I've written are, here it is, here's a bad situation, you know, what are you going to do about it? But I disagree that a slow build-up doesn't, you know, can't be at least as effective. And this is perhaps where I differ from a lot of people who write for Call of Cthulhu, in that I never really think of the things that I'm writing as investigations. I think of them as being situations in which characters will find themselves, that there are things that they don't understand, that there are things that are going to place them in danger. There are things that they might be able to do to mitigate that by learning more about it. But I tend to think of it far more in terms of, you know, here's a bad situation, here's how player characters might get involved with it. If I can get the players to come up with ways of getting their characters involved with it even better, and then let's see how this plays out. And yes, I mean, there will be clues and so on that they might find, but yeah, I don't tend to think of it as, you know, here's a series of clues, here's an investigation. It is just, you know, how are you going to survive this? How are you going to get through this?
And then the last question, this is really specific. do you think, for the purpose of this game, it will be more tense to have just the PCs and whatever environment and threat there is, or to have them in amongst a load of other NPCs and kind of not bystanders, but kind of, you know, like background characters? Do you think focusing on, if we're trying to create something scary, I don't mean in terms of whether it's a successful game, but if we want to create this tension and horror, let's say, if we can,
I've often said that I think for horror games, particularly one shots, that isolation is a vital component to that. But it's worth explaining what isolation can mean, because yes, it can be exactly what you described. It's just the player characters. They're somewhere where there's an existential threat, and there's no one around who can help with that. And that is a classic that really works. And it's a great recipe for horror. But equally, there are other types of isolation. There's social isolation as well. So, I mean, the player characters could be somewhere where there are other people around. It's just that they're not going to be able to get help from them. Maybe because they're not going to be believed, or that there's social class reasons or bigotry or something like that at work that's going to stop them being able to call upon the same help as other people. Or maybe they just, there are other people around, but they just don't know who they can trust. That, if it is something conspiratorial or whatever, then yeah, they feel isolated that way. So isolation doesn't have to be, yes, all right, you're all on this remote Scottish island, there's something hunting you. It can be, I wrote a scenario for Nameless Horrors called Bleak Prospect, in which the characters are all people living in a shanty town in the
Oh,
Great
yeah, I
Depression,
know it. Yeah.
who are right on the edge of a city,
They're all hobos.
but yeah, that's right. But
Yeah.
because of their social class, the authorities won't help them. There's basically no one they can call on. There are people all around, but if they try to access the same kind of help as other people in the town might expect, they're just going to get laughed off or worse, be subject to police brutality.
I think there's another type of isolation as well, the one that's used quite a lot in horror films, where all the people around you, they all just are being slaughtered in droves. You realize
Yes.
that they're not going to be any help at all because they're all being
Yes.
eaten.
Yes. Yeah. And there is definitely something to be said for setting the stakes of what's going on by absolutely massacring an NPC in front of the player characters.
Wonderful. Okay, well, look, we've been going over an hour. I could talk to you about so many other things, but I wanted this to be very much about this idea of creating horror. We still we did talk once about possibly doing a conversation about Alan Moore and his Lovecraftian work,
Oh
but
yeah.
I think we'll probably save that for another day or another year.
I think that's possibly an entire podcast series in itself.
Oh,
Am
and I've lost
I
you.
lagging again? Oh shit. Hang on. Am I back yet? Oh,
Oh yeah, you're back now. You're back now.
oh
Yeah,
no, sorry, I was just saying
well,
I think that's
so
possibly an
anyway,
entire podcast series in itself.
it probably is. It probably is. Well, just to finish on one thing, because I've been rereading Neal Stephenson's Baroque Cycle recently. I don't know
Oh
if
yeah.
you've read it or know it at all.
No, I've read some
And what's great
Stevenson and
about
about that.
that? Well, I mean, that it's set in the late 17th, early 18th century, world-spanning, typical Stevenson, like overwriting. It's 3,000 pages, I think, the three books.
Yes.
But what's great about it is he really brings home how people were just perfectly okay with the most horrible bodily things that happened to them back then, because you had to be, because it was going to happen to you, whether it's your cock dropping off because a doctor accidentally dropped the hot iron on you when he was trying to cure you of the French pox, to convulsive diarrhea, to treatment of all kinds of diseases and illnesses, to the cutting someone for the stone, and just it's just brilliant on that. So we had a
Oh,
very
nice.
different attitude, I think, to body horror back then than we have now.
Yes, I'll have to catch up with those at some stage.
Highly recommended, but you do have to put up with several hundred pages of Isaac Newton and Leibniz talking about calculus. So,
Okay. Right.
swings and
I shall be
roundabouts.
prepared. I read computer science at university, which is mostly maths anyway. So yeah, I've done my time in the calculus mind, so I can probably cope with it.
Wonderful. All right, well, Scott, thank you so much. And I will be seeing you very soon, in a
Yes.
couple of weeks' time for our investigative, pure investigative game. I mean, this is investigation to the nth degree, what we're doing now, isn't it? It's quite surprising.
Well, except for all the parts where we're just sort of blundering through it and seeing what happens, yes.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not saying you're competent investigators. All I'm saying is you are investigating.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, I got to say, I've been thoroughly enjoying playing with you. Long may it continue. I've got.
Yes, likewise.
Thank you. And I've got so many more things like on the in tray, things that we could do and play. Because I've also downloaded a bunch of Unspeakable Oath scenarios, which are really good,
All right.
actually. There's some great stuff in there. There's one I downloaded that essentially it feels very much like the guy that wrote True Detective must have read that scenario.
Oh wow. Oh God, I don't know
It really feels like that.
if I ever mentioned this. There's a while back on Reddit, I can't remember. It was I think it was on the True Detective subreddit. It might have been on the Trail of Cthulhu one, but there was a thread on there where someone was talking about how they were convinced that Nick Pizzolatto had ripped off True Detective from the final revelation, the scenario I wrote for Trail of Cthulhu.
Really?
That just blew my mind. I don't see it at all, but it just amused the hell out of me.
I will have to check that out. I've never run or even read any Trail of Cthulhu. I really should. Now that I'm digging deeper and wider, I will check it out. But thanks anyway, Scott, for giving me all your time today, and we will see you anon on many other podcasts.
Marvelous. Thank you very much, Andy.
Here we are. Here we are. I heard a very, well, I suppose you could call it very depressing statistic, depending on your perspective. As of, and I looked it up. Well, there's a podcast actually, which is kind of interesting. If you make podcasts, it's about as meta as it gets. Called The Audacity to Podcast. Get it? The
Oh yes.
Audacity to Podcast. Oh, you know
I
it?
am aware of it. I've listened to a few episodes, but not for a while.
Yeah, I mean it's I'm sure it's got lots of useful stuff on there, but because I downloaded an episode and it said there are now 1 million podcasts out there. I listened to
Yeah.
that and I thought, oh for fuck's sake, 1 million podcasts. And then he said,
Yeah.
but listen back to my previous episode for more detail when it was the 800,000 podcasts. So I was looking at the dates and the 800,000 podcasts, that was December 2019. The
Wow.
million podcast was April 2020. And as of today, there are over 2 million podcasts
Holy shit.
out there. That's kind of
Yeah.
mind-blowing, isn't it, really?
Well, I guess it makes sense to some extent if you think about the last year. Everyone's moved online. They're used to talking into microphones. They're used to talking to people remotely. A lot of people have now bought webcams and decent microphones. And so the infrastructure to record podcasts is just now in everyone's home.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
But
But
I don't know if it's still the case. I do remember hearing a few years back that, yeah, I mean, all right, there are a lot of podcasts out there, but the vast majority, like 80 to 90%, have got maybe not single figure downloads, but close. But you know, they average like 20 downloads per episode.
Yes. Yeah, I was looking at a stat that said if you, and this is, sounds crazy to me, but if you have more than 125 downloads in your first week, you're in the top 25% of podcasts out there, which really says it all, doesn't it? I mean, that's not a lot, is it?
Well, I think they were saying that if you get something like 10,000 a month or whatever, you're in the top 10. And that's not that many.
You don't have to answer this if you don't want. I know that these people get a bit funny about numbers, but how many people listen to your podcast each episode? I'm just really curious.
It varies an awful lot depending on the subject.
Because you're pretty famous.
Oh, I wouldn't say that by any means. No, I mean, the podcast listenership isn't huge. The smaller episodes...
You must get several thousand.
I mean, the smaller episodes get about 2,500, and I think the highest number we've ever had is about 6,500. The average number we get is about 3,500, I think.
I think that puts you in a very good category, to be honest. I mean, I know something just anecdotally from podcasting friends, some of whom have one podcast that get quite a lot of listeners. And yeah, I mean, they're not getting that kind of number. They're getting like, you know, 1,000 per episode or 400, 500, you know. So, well, you know, kudos. I'm nowhere near that, by the way.
But I mean, it takes a long time. I mean, for the first... I think 4 years, 5 years of The Good Friends, we were getting about 300 or 400 downloads per episode, and then something changed. I think we just...
Was it?
I think... Okay.
Go on. No, go
on. I think it was a combination of sort of learning what we were doing in terms of audio production and having some decent equipment. I think it was having built up a certain critical mass of listeners that were getting the words out to other people. And also, I think... Patreon, bizarrely, I mean, I don't know if that just made people feel more invested in the podcast, but you know, a combination of that and doing the Blasphemous Tone fanzine and having a few, you know, better known guests on, and all of a sudden, our figures just shot through the roof within about 18 months.
That's interesting you should say that, because I think, from what I understand at least, that it's more, with generally with Patreon and Kickstarter, it's the other way around, isn't it? You need to build up an audience before you're going to get anyone to fork out any cash. But I guess if you're giving something more with the Patreon, like the Blasphemous Tome and stuff like that, I guess. Would it not also have coincided with the three of you being more involved with Chaosium and publishing stuff?
No, that actually started before we did the podcast. We did the podcast in the first place because we'd all worked on Call of Cthulhu 7th edition, and we knew we liked working together, and we were looking for other projects, and we thought, yeah, it'd be nice to get the word out there, see what other business we can get. And I mean, initially, at least, starting the podcast was perhaps a very optimistic and misguided attempt to build up a bit more of a reputation, get our names out there, and think it might make the writing easier. And I mean, slowly over the last 8 years, which is what we've been going for now, it's sort of, at least for me, sort of largely taken over from the writing. I spend far more time on podcasting than I do on writing now.
Well, I don't know if you've heard me refer to you, Scott, but you are the hardest working man in podcasts. That's what I refer to you as. I'm not sure you can do the James Brown splits, but you're on that level.
I could probably split my trousers, but not my legs.
So I realise we've gone straight into the topic without really even an introduction. So let me just record a quick intro to you, because this is part of a series, actually a mini series, which is going to go out on both of my podcasts. So let me just look at the timestamp on my thing. It's 12 minutes. Yeah, I can mark it. Okay.